Good evening, everybody, and good evening to our campuses. We are excited about what God is doing. I mean, we're just excited. We opened up our campuses to going deeper, and we had a better turnout than we even hoped. So we are really grateful to God. Also, some of the folks that used to come to this service are now at campuses. So guess what? We have extra seats. So it is a great time to invite folks. It's a great time. That's right, Sharon, for now. So it's a great time to invite folks. We also kicked off our brand new 8 o'clock worship service here at the Fairview Heights campus. We had 191 people come at 8 o'clock. I got to tell you, I got here before church to come in and pray and get ready. And all I could think about is, it's still dark. It is still dark. But thank you for everybody. And the other thing I noticed about people that come to 8 o'clock church, they're all perky. They're all morning people. They were in the best mood. Even like at 6 o'clock church on Sunday night, I have people who've just awakened. And they're just coming in like this, you know. But that 8 o'clock group, what a delightful group. Thank those of you that shifted over. We're so excited about what God is doing at Christ Church. And a good metaphor for that is we've just kind of added a whole lot of things. We thinned ourselves out, and now it's time to kind of eat some good spiritual food, as my grandma used to say, to put a little meat on our bones, all right? And so tonight we're going to take a look at worship. I'm going to argue that worship is the most important thing a church does. And I'm going to equally argue that many people who attend church every Sunday and have their whole life have no idea what worship truly is. So let's get at it. Incidentally, this is coming in two parts. Everybody raise a two up. Yeah, this is part one. Next week is part two. So you may or may not leave tonight and think, he didn't even talk about the scripture. All right, so there we go. In Matthew 22, Jesus' ministry is selling out venues all over Galilee. Simply put, Jesus is the hottest ticket in Israel. The problem is that his sudden notoriety, combined with his anti-establishment message, is being met by a group of very powerful enemies. The guardians of the Jewish religious establishment were predictably threatened by the emergence of Jesus of Nazareth, and frankly, they should have been. On this occasion, a group of religious leaders called Pharisees, they're the true holy rollers. When you hear Sadducees in the Bible, they're sort of collaborationists with Rome. They're a little bit of sellouts. They're kind of in, they got a hand in both pockets, all right? The Pharisees are the legit holy rollers. Jesus is pretty tough on them, but I think he's tough on them because they seem so close to getting it right as opposed to being the most wrong. So the Pharisees are there, and they're trying to trip Jesus up. They understand this man's trouble. And they ask him a trick question in a public debate. And they know full well that the people who are listening to Jesus are divided right down the middle on what the purpose of the Jewish faith is. About half of the people thought the purpose of the Jewish faith was to worship God, and the other half of the people thought the purpose of the Jewish faith was to help people. I bet you today, in most churches, we'd be kind of split down the middle as well. What is the main function of the church? Some people would say it's to worship God, but other people would say, I don't know. Maybe it's to help people. This is going on, so they devise this question that's sort of sure to lose Jesus at least half of his constituency, all right? They devise a question knowing the climate of the people that is going to split things. It would be like if I'm in a public debate, we're doing a question and answer with me here at church on a Sunday morning, and someone asked me a highly hot item political question that I knew that this congregation was probably divided right down the middle on. That is what's happened to Jesus here, okay? He has gotten a really, really tough question. So here it is, Matthew 22, 34 through 40. But when the Pharisees heard he had silenced the Sadducees with his reply, they met together to question him again. One of them, an expert in religious law, he's a religious lawyer, he tries to trap him with this question. Teacher, which is the most important commandment in the law of Moses? You get it. If Jesus says it's to worship God, half the people say yeah, and the other half goes, ah. If he says it's to help people, half go, ah, and the other half go, yeah. So this is a trick question. This is going to cut his support base in half. And Jesus replied, You must love the Lord your God with all your heart, all your soul, and all your mind. This is the first and greatest commandment. And a second is equally important. Love your neighbor as yourself. The entire law and the demands of the prophets are based on these two commandments. The brilliance of Jesus' response is found in the lack of a conjunction. Yeah. Remember, those of you that are, oh, conjunction, junction, what's your function? It's in the lack of a conjunction. I'm going to guess there wasn't a fraction of a second that elapsed between verses 38 and 39. We can extrapolate three things from Jesus' response, and here they go. Number one, loving God is the most important thing we do. Number two, loving people is almost as important. And number three, loving God and loving people are somehow interconnected. There's a relationship somehow between the two. With that being said, let's get back into our Christchurch DNA. Say it with me, our mission: we exist to connect people with Jesus Christ. Our strategy: to reach out, welcome, and disciple through worship and service. In this Ecclesia series, we've been exploring the DNA of the big C, Church of Jesus Christ, and the little c, Christ Church. In week one, we probed our mission over the last several weeks, we've been exploring our strategy. Now that we've reached out, welcomed, and discipled, I would like to spend the next 2 weeks on worship, loving God. And then I want to finish up this series with some thoughts on service. It'll either be 1 or 2 weeks. I didn't mean for this one to be 2 weeks, but honestly, I got done and I had an hour and a half of material. And so I thought I better divide it in two. Either that or ask people to come in their pajamas and bring sleeping bags, okay? Keep in mind that worship or loving God is how we spiritually eat, and loving people or service is how we spiritually exercise. Is everybody with me there? If you exercise a lot and don't eat, you get one set of problems. If you eat a lot and don't exercise, you get a different set of problems. The key to health is balancing diet and exercise. So worship is how we eat. Imagine God pouring into us. Service is how we exercise. Imagine the God in us pouring out to other people. All right? Worship intake, service outflow. So what I want to do is I want to begin this two-part message with a single question. What does it really mean to worship God? Worship is a difficult word to define in the English language because it refers to a unique connection and an accompanying group of emotions for which we have no real nomenclature. We just don't have the words to describe worship. Now, there have been a lot of people, including the great Harvard scholar William James, who have kind of gone into the psychological end of what happens when you worship and religion and all of those kind of things. But the reality is you can study it all you want, but there is something that happens in worship that we can't quantify, that we can't draw up a mathematical formula to represent. There's something beyond our ability to describe it that happens when we worship. I mean, how do you describe it when the finite collides with the infinite? How do you describe an encounter that humans trapped in skin and time and space, the creation, how do you describe it when we truly take a walk with the Creator and all of God's limitless vastness? How do you describe those kind of words? We can make one up. I mean, we can make a word up. I thought of Theo Combust Acecticus. And that would be a word, but it's really not going to catch on. My wife, Melissa, offers my favorite definition of the encounter. Read it with me. Worship happens when our hearts and God's heart become one. Worship happens when two hearts become one. Things like church services and singing individually or corporately, being in a connect group, a Bible study, remembering our baptisms, tithing, serving others in Jesus' name, hearing the word preached, communion, community prayer, they're all pathways to worship, but they're not worship in themselves. They're pathways, but they're not worship in themselves. Worship has nothing to do with navigating a bulletin or walking through a communion station, or plowing through an order of worship. Worship is not about engaging in a religious task. Worship is about making a connection. Is everybody with me there? The pathway is just the pathway, but it may not get you there. But worship is when you actually make the connection. In some ways, when we worship, it's like seeing the stars. I can't see the stars for you, but I can give you hints that could help. For example, you'll have better luck at night. You'll have better luck if you're outside. You'll have better luck if you're in the country. You'll have better luck if you look up. You'll have better luck if your eyes are open. You'll have better luck if it's not cloudy. There's a whole lot of things. I can't see the stars for you, but I can infinitely help you and place you in a position to see the stars for yourselves. You see, some nights the stars are highly visible, and we are too busy to look up. But other nights, the stars are equally visible, but for some reason we slow down, and we actually behold them. What I like best about deer hunting has nothing to do with hunting deer. In fact, I don't really like deer meat very much. I was at Arby's today, and they offered a new venison sandwich. And I thought, that's poor competition for a good old American cow. Poor competition. So I had them slice me off some roast beef. The thing I love most about deer hunting is the sky. When you walk out in the morning and it's just cold, and the sky is just so gorgeous. And it looks like God just took a million diamonds and just threw them across an endless sea of black velvet. It's stunning. Have you guys ever seen the Milky Way? When it just looks like somebody just took a knife and ripped the sky and all these diamonds just poured out of it. I got to tell you, when I see a night sky or when somebody hits a deer and we got to track it at night, they're all looking for the deer. I don't care if we find the deer. I'd just as well not find the deer, all right? You find the deer, you got to gut it, you got to pull it in, you got to haul it out. Horrible, all right? I'm out there just looking at the sky, man. I'm looking at the sky, and I'm thinking, God, can you cook or what? Wow. And you know what? When you see the sky, and when you behold it, all of a sudden something happens. Sight and synapse can make a moment unforgettable. We are overwhelmed, and the encounter is not only imprinted within us. I would have to say that some encounters change us somehow. Even encounters with nature, they change us somehow. What we try to do at church is give you every opportunity to truly encounter God. But in the end, whether or not you worship is up to you. I can't do it for you. We can worship in front of you. We can try to limit distractions. We can attempt to lead you into worship, but we can't worship for you. We can sing and invite you to sing along. We can pray and invite you to pray along. We can proclaim the word and invite you to follow along, but we cannot worship for you. If a connection with God is not made, worship by definition has not occurred, whether you attended church or not. Let's say that one more time. If an encounter with God is not made, worship has not occurred, whether you attended church or not. The Greek word for worship is proskuneo. It's a compound word, and it means to turn towards someone for the purpose of giving them a kiss. Is that just the oddest definition in the whole world? To turn towards someone for the purpose of giving them a kiss. Now, this establishes several things about worship that drive our metaphor of stargazing home, okay? Stargazing is not worship. Stargazing is just looking and seeing what God has made, all right? But let me kind of use that as a metaphor, as something you can only see for yourself. Let's hit this. Let me tell you six things we know about worship. I'll pour them in the container of the metaphor. Number one, worship happens at the initiative of God. God created the stars. You couldn't go star watching had God not made the stars. You would just be sky looking, all right? But God made the stars. So worship is God's idea. We were made to worship God. God desires to be worshiped. God is pleased by our worship. You know, a lot of times when we pray, we say, God, what can you do for me? Worship is what we do for God. So worship comes at the initiative of God. Number two, you have to turn toward God. Remember, proscunio means to turn toward. In order to see the stars, you got to go like this. You have to turn away. These days, you'd have to go like this. You have to turn away from your phone that you stare at, and you have to turn a different direction. You got to look up to see the stars. I think there are people who have attended hundreds of worship services, even thousands of worship services in their life, but they've never truly worshiped God because they never look up. They never look up. Number three, you have to turn away from everything but God. If you're turning towards something, you are by definition turning away from something else. So looking at the stars means you're not looking at your phone, right? Looking at your stars means you're not looking down. Looking at the stars means you're not looking at something else. You turn your attention away from something to encounter something else. This has to do with limiting distractions. And I think sometimes the question is, think about how you come to church. Think about what you bring to church. I'm going to be very frank. I think a lot of people bring a lot of distractions with them. I think they bring a lot of distractions with them. Why? Because I think a lot of people are afraid of truly worshiping God. They're afraid of what might happen if they actually worship God. True worshipers are going to limit distractions. If you think about it, what we do at church is we limit distractions for you. We try to provide a setting where you're focused on God, where we're pouring the word into you. Those of you that have kids, we've covered that, right? Those of you that have teenagers, we've covered that. We are trying to take all the potential distractions away. Now, you got your phones. Whether you use those to check in and take notes, or whether you use those to look at Twitter or to Instagram, that is up to you. I can't control that. But I can tell you, if you're going to worship, you're going to have to limit distractions. Because what the devil really tries to do when we worship is distract us. The last thing Satan wants you to do tonight is have an encounter with God. I guarantee you that. He doesn't care if you buy something off of eBay, but he does not want you to have an encounter with God. Number four, worship is intimate. It's a kiss. Now, we often think of kiss in a romantic sense, but you got to remember, in those days, a kiss is a sign of greeting. But you don't kiss people you don't know, all right? It's the way you greet a friend. Remember, Judas betrayed Jesus, what? With a kiss. It's a sign of greeting. But the bottom line is this. Worship is an intimate connection. So there's got to be a connection between what you're seeing and what you feel. If you're looking at the stars, you can see them, but does it connect in such a way that it evokes a feeling? Does it connect in that way? You see, a kiss can represent many emotions, but a kiss is not just a casual thing. It's truly more intimate than that. There is emotion in cultures where they give people a kiss on both cheeks. Look at the enthusiasm with which they do it. There's enthusiasm brought into that. To kiss someone is to know someone and to have someone know something of you. A kiss celebrates that special knowledge. So to turn away from something less divine, to turn toward something more divine for the purpose of offering a kiss. Number five, worship is not something you can do alone. The connection is the encounter. Do you know no matter how much you like you can't kiss yourself? You can lick your lips. You can smack your lips. But you can't kiss yourself, regardless of how narcissistic you may be. You just can't do it. You see, God must be present for worship to occur. If God is not the sole object of our attentions, we are engaged in something other than worship. I want to suggest to you, some people will hear the word proclaimed and they are engaged in an academic exercise, but they're not worshiping God. Some people will pray and they'll be thinking about something else. They're certainly not worshiping God. Some people will sing and they might even like the music, right? It's like you died and went to the old American bandstand. It's got a good beat and it's easy to dance to. But that doesn't mean you're worshiping God. We have two choices each time we come to church. We have the choice of coming to church or staying home. That's choice A. And then choice B is once we get here, we have the choice of truly worshiping or just sitting in the building. And here's what I want to suggest to you. If you're going to put out all the effort to get here and to show up, you might as well worship. I mean, you might as well worship. I mean, I go to the baseball games back when the Cardinals used to make the playoffs. I would go to baseball games like in the playoffs, and I look around and everybody's looking at their phones. And I'm saying, do you people understand you could look at your phones at home for free? It would cost you nothing to look at your phone at home for free. Why would you pay a lot of money and not engage in the ball game? So guys, why would you put out a lot of time, effort, and energy to get here and not engage in worship? Why would you get here and then somehow passive-aggressively fail to worship God? When I go to ball games, I think those guys that like paint their heads and their bodies and wear all kinds of gaudy things and all that, I think those people are a little weird, but let me tell you something, they are engaged. I don't want to set by one, but they're engaged. Why would you come and not engage? But that's the choice. You have the choice to stay home or to attend church, but once you get here, you have the choice to worship or just sit in a building. I think we need to choose well. And then number six, the Bible leads us into worship. You see, creation testifies to the Creator. You know what I see when I see a night sky full of stars? It's like a painting. It tells me something of the artist. The painting's not the artist, but it does tell me something of the artist. I know that artist a little better because I have seen their painting. You look at enough Rembrandts, you get to know Rembrandt a little bit. You look at enough Norman Rockwells. You get to know Norman Rockwell a little bit. I could show you a lot of Norman Rockwell's paintings, and you could probably extrapolate some very correct things about Norman Rockwell. And nature and God's creation testify to God. They're not God. The worship of creation is called pantheism. It's straight up paganism. Worship of nature is not what we're talking about, but nature does testify to the glory of the Creator. The Bible leads us into worship. Look at all the Psalms where the psalmist is just blown away by nature. Why? David wrote a lot of the Psalms. What did David do when he was a boy? What was his job? Shepherds. What do shepherds do at night? Not much. They look at the stars. They hope there aren't bears. They play harmonicas, or in David's day, flutes. David saw a lot of sky. And read the Psalms sometime to see how much of nature sparks something inside the psalmist. You see, God reveals himself to us through Scripture. I believe that Jesus is the best insight into God, and I believe that the Bible is the best insight into Jesus. What is the best way to get to know God? Through the Bible. Through the Bible. Jesus gives us that insight into God. The Bible testifies to it. And I'm going to share with you a very strong theological place for me. God does not reveal himself to us in ways that contradict the clear and consistent teachings of the Bible. So what I want to tell you, somebody says, well, God says this or God says that. If it is in violation of the clear and consistent teachings of the Bible, we know God didn't say that at all. You just thought that up. You just thought that up. I had somebody come up to me a while back and they said, God told me blah, 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 blah. And then they saw him another time and said, God told me blah, blah, blah. And then God told me blah, blah, blah. And I looked at him. I said, you know what? For 400 years between the Old and New Testament, God was silent. It is shocking he's so chatty with you. Shocking.
Shocking.
The Bible leads us into worship. The Bible invites us into worship. God most often and most accurately speaks to us through his word. Most often and most accurately. So you want a pathway to worship? Read the Bible. Read the Bible. I believe that the corporate worship of God is not only the most important thing a church does, it is the foundation of everything a church does. If a church doesn't worship, truly worship, nothing else they do is going to be right. So it does not surprise me that conflict in church often comes over worship, specifically worship styles. All right? Think about it. If you're the devil, I mean, I know it's not a great thought, but if you're the devil and you're trying to disrupt God's work and you're going to attack the church, wouldn't you try to get the church fussing within itself? That's what I would try to do. Turn the church against itself. And so it is very interesting to me that historically one of the things the church has really fought a lot about is worship style. How we worship, how we do music, what is the best pathway to lead people into the worship of God? Because Satan knows that if he can get churches expending energy debating what should happen in worship services, they'll be far less likely to actually worship. You show me a church in a worship war, I'll show you people who are not worshiping God. We all know that worship can be inward, outward, high or low, fast or slow. But it's not the style that defines worship. It's whether or not a connection is made. I believe the true Christian should be able to make a connection with God anywhere the Bible is proclaimed and Christ is lifted up, regardless of whether or not you connect with the style. Is everybody with me there? Regardless. But we all have personal preferences, don't we? And I think that's where we get tripped up. What we often forget is that what we consider to be the good old style was once the bad new style. Psalm 91 calls for us to sing a new song unto the Lord. Say that with me. Sing a new song unto the Lord. This imperative assures that worship, though timeless, will always have a relevant edge to it, a cultural connect, a forward-moving energy. Each generation composes its songs to the Lord, and that's actually a good thing. And in times of great revival, one of the characteristics of a great revival is there's a lot of new music that comes from it. You look at times in the hymnal, look at an old hymnal, look at times and write the dates when the songs were written, they tend to bunch up. They tend to bunch up, and they'll bunch up around historic revivals and great movements of God, and they also bunch up around national tragedies like the Civil War, all right? They kind of bunch up around those type of things. Each generation has its own song that it sings to the Lord. I remember when I was a kid, the generation of the late 60s and early 70s, I mean, it was kind of guitars, right? It was kind of guitars, and it was a very different kind of thing. So I want to tell you, singing a new song to the Lord is not only a good thing, it's a biblical thing. But it doesn't always feel great. You know, in our own Methodist tradition, Charles Wesley, the brother of founder John Wesley, wrote over 6,000 hymns. 6,000 hymns. I always got on him for wearing those wigs back then, and now I'm starting to think I might need one. So Wesley, when he was writing all of his hymns, was hotly criticized for bringing tavern music into the church. The bottom line is that he wrote highly theological lyrics to teach people common doctrine, but he set his hymns to popular English bar hall melodies so the people could quickly learn them. I remember the first song I ever wrote. I came up on the music side of things, and I wrote a gazillion songs when I was young and coming up. The first song I ever wrote was called Where the People Pray, and it was to the tune of Margaritaville by Jimmy Buffett, you know. And in my mind, I was operating in the tradition of Charles Wesley, but in reality, it was just terrible. All right. The old style people, when they heard Charles Wesley hymns, were outraged. I mean, never mind that they allowed non-church people to feel at home at church because they at least knew the tunes. Never mind the rhyming lyrics formed much of their initial theology. Never mind the Methodist movement was driven by this new style music and transformed England and America. Charles Wesley's pragmatic new style was simply more than most good Anglicans could bear. And that these tavern tunes would be played and accompanied by such a crude, popular, and vulgar instrument as the piano. And not a pipe organ. Not a pipe organ. Only exacerbated the tension. There was real controversy around this. The traditional Anglicans asked, "What's this world coming to?" And Charles Wesley replied, "To Christ. To Christ." Here's a slightly sardonic recollection that I'm going to include in my new book that's coming out next month. It's a memory, and I'm going to share it with you. I remember the first time we did a chorus at the Oak Grove Baptist Church when I was a kid. I think it was the Renegade song, "His Banner Over Me Is Love." I remember watching the people cringe. After all, were we not singing a song accompanied by the guitar, the same instrument played by known drug user Jimi Hendrix? Were we not participating blindly in what were quite possibly hand motions that may have been used in satanic rituals and other secret societies? Could anyone argue that this song was to be found nowhere in the Brodmann hymnal and thus was not cleared by God for use in church services? And then I remember my mom's high school all-girl singing group, Joy. One Sunday, they covered Simon and Garfunkel's "Bridge Over Troubled Water" in church before Dad preached. Troubled water, indeed. Forget that young people saw a connection between church culture and everyday life for the first time. Forget that the lyrics had strong Christian implications and illustrated the text perfectly. Forget that our church was literally filling up with young people. The guardians of tradition were sure that Joy would break into the Rolling Stone Satisfaction the next week if something were not done, and done right now. Wesley was singing in 1772, freaking out the Anglicans, and my mom was singing in 1972, freaking out the Baptists. So it certainly appears that whatever controversy you think is happening in the wide, wide world of church music is not new. So here's the deal. What's the new style today will be the old style tomorrow, and I hope we don't fight as hard for it as the previous generations have. And it's not a bad thing. Worship is best communicated in the collective cultural forms and songs and art of those attempting to encounter God. Now, let me unwedge my tongue from my cheek, and let's move along. The bottom line is that when we truly worship, when a connection with God is truly made, we are changed. We are changed. Connections may come from worship services, a mission trip you took, a single song or a single set, a mountain hike, an incredible book that opened new things up for you, a spiritual retreat, experiencing a powerful sermon. These connections can come in a myriad of ways. And for many of us, times of powerful connection are forever imprinted in our memories. When you really encounter God, you don't forget it. You don't forget it. We all connect differently, but what is important is that we connect. And the more ways we learn to connect, the more connecting we are going to do. The serious disciple is constantly putting themselves in a position to connect with God. We are constantly placing ourselves voluntarily in a position to encounter God. Dr. Seuss said the best way to find a missing object is to find out where it's not. So let's take a look at what worship isn't, seven things, and then I'll close by looking at seven things worship is. All right? Here we go. Seven things worship is not. Number one, worship is not a church service. We call them worship services, but that's highly optimistic. Highly optimistic. A church service is an opportunity to worship, but it's not one and the same. Just because you went to church doesn't necessarily mean you worshiped. Can I hear an amen from somebody? And we've all been to church when we didn't worship, right? One of my problems as a pastor is that I've been taught to look at everything critically, so I have trouble just going to church. Do you know what I'm talking about? I have trouble just going to church. I'm thinking about what they're doing, why they're doing it. Something really cool happens. I say, man, that was good. I need to write that down. You know, and I have this detachment, this distance, and you'll never be able to worship God at a distance. You can't kiss from a distance. You got to worship God close, not far. So worship is not a church service. Number two, worship is not a place. You know, worship doesn't just happen at church. It's not a place. Number three, worship is not just a feeling. You know, to quote Boston, it's more than a feeling. It's a whole lot more than a feeling. In fact, feelings can kind of fly all over the place. Worship is not a feeling. It's not just feeling it. I remember a few years back, maybe not a few years back, maybe a couple of years back, we were doing one of our cover series where we were doing cover music. And they were playing Jackson Browne's Running on Empty. The band was, you know. And I'm sitting there just having a great time. You talk about just kind of in my wheelhouse, you know. They're playing this. I'm just having a great time. And my hand almost went up. And I thought, stop that. What are you doing? What are you doing? You guys know what I'm talking about. It's not a feeling. It's not getting sucked into something that you feel. Number four, worship is not just for the highly emotional. So some people who are more cerebral, and let me tell you something, just because you run things through your brain doesn't mean you're excused from worship. You still need to worship God. You may do it a little different. You may do it with a little less energy. That's okay. But let me tell you something. All of us need to be worshiping God. All of us need to be worshiping God. You think we're going to go to heaven? God's going to say, everybody wants to worship, come over here. And everybody just wants to sit around and think. You go over there. It's not going to happen. We all need to worship God. Number five, worship is not an affinity. Worship is not just because you like it. I like that worship service, so that was a great worship service. Or I didn't like that worship service. Worship has nothing to do with you and me. Nothing to do with what we like or our personal preferences. It's not what it's about. Number six, worship is not a prescribed process. You know, when I was a kid, we used to follow the bulletin, and my biggest hope when I was a kid is that we would soon get out of church. And I would just follow the bulletin, and I would check things off as they happened, and then I would get to the sermon, and I thought, man, we're going to be hosed here for like 45 minutes, you know? We just couldn't seem to get off the sermon. Worship is not a prescribed process that we just check off. It's not running an order of worship from 1958. That's not what we're doing. Number seven, worship is not a cognitive exercise. And it's been something that I've struggled with my whole life. I'm somewhat suspicious of just wild emotion because wild emotion, a lot of times not tethered to anything. It's kind of like an untied off balloon. It just kind of, and I've seen a lot of people go in my life. I always want there to be something there. I've always seen the cognitive end of things, just drilling down deep into the theological and doctrinal end of things is kind of where I want to tether myself. It gets back to what Zach was talking about Sunday when we tether ourselves to the cross. Not just dance around the cross, but you actually tether yourself to it. But worship has to have an emotional aspect to it. I mean, it's got to have that as well. And so for me, a lot of times to truly engage in worship, I just have to tell my mind to shut up for a few minutes. You know, just tell my mind to shut up. And it's funny because I'm able to do it at ball games. You know, usually at ball games I'm pretty self-conscious because I don't want to appear like a raving idiot like, you know, so many people do. And you know, I just see people and they're just wild and out of control. And I think, man, that's not where I want to be. And they scream and they say dumb things and all that. And I don't want to do that. But you know what? When a big hit comes, I don't think about that. I'm not sitting there thinking, well, that's jolly good. You know, when that big hit comes, somehow my emotions override my self-consciousness. And I stand up and I cheer and I yell. Man, there's got to be times when we stand up and cheer and yell for Jesus.
there got to be times when he just gets a hold of us. And it overrides our self-consciousness. And it even overrides our cognition. And it says, we serve a God who's worthy to be praised. And sometimes you need to think about it. And sometimes you don't need to think about it. Sometimes you just need to shut up and praise the Lord. If I ever made a line of t-shirts, that'd be one of my shirts. Shut up and praise the Lord. It's a good thing to do. Let me give you seven characteristics of true worship. Number one, worship is a choice. It's a choice. God isn't going to make you worship him. Every time you come to church, you have a choice. You can worship or not. And many of you, and I will wholeheartedly confess, there have been times that I've gone to church and I chose not to worship. I chose to distract myself. And I'm making a shopping list or I'm thinking about something else. I've told the story a gazillion times. I was at an annual conference one year and the bishop at the time was preaching. And I'm looking at my phone and I am bidding on a baseball that Johnny Bench signed. And that's a distraction. I mean, I won the ball. That feels like a win even now. But it was a distraction. So worship's a choice. Choose to worship. You just got to decide you're going to. Are you going to worship? I mean, I think it'd be a great thing to say to people before they came to church. You here to worship today? You're just going to sit around. I mean, that's great. I like that. You know, you here to worship today? You're just here to socialize. Hope somebody buys something you're selling. You here to worship today? Or are you just kind of lonesome? Worship's a choice. Number two, worship is a connection. Worship is a connection. It's when God and me are God and you. It's when we connect with each other. It's not a feeling. It's a connection. Does the connection produce a feeling? Of course it does. But it is not a feeling. It is a connection. Number three, worship is egalitarian. And what I mean by that is that worship's for everybody. You don't have to be an ordained pastor to worship. You don't have to have a seminary degree to worship. In fact, most of the people I know who have seminary degrees were better worshipers before they got it. And so the reality is, worship is just for everybody. You don't have to have theological courses to worship God. You don't have to have a church membership card. You don't have to have a decoder ring. You don't have to have any of that kind of stuff to worship God. It's for everybody. We were all created to worship. We were all created to worship God. Who am I to worship God? You are son and daughter of the Most High God, and it is an appropriate and good thing for you to worship your Creator. Doesn't matter if you're young or old. Every now and then in church, somebody will have like a two-year-old there, like when we do baby baptisms or something like that, and there'll be a two-year-old, and they're usually on the front row. We'll be singing, and that two-year-old will be out there. Man, they'll just be going like this, you know. And they're just jumping up and down. The parents never know what to do, and I'll always walk over to the parents, and I'll say, she gets it. She gets it. You? But her. Her. She gets it. She gets it. Me? Her. She gets it. Worship is egalitarian. We can all worship God. One of the things we try to do in Creation Corner is create an environment for children to learn how to worship God. It's really, really important. So it's for everybody. Number four, worship is transforming. When you worship, you will not be the same on the other side. When you really encounter God, the ride lets you off somewhere differently than where you got on. It's just how it rolls. You know, I do a lot of hiking. Melissa and I do a lot of hiking, but most of those hikes, you end up where you started. It's a big loop. But worship is not a big loop. Worship actually takes you somewhere. It takes you somewhere, and it lets you off somewhere different than where you got in. I always think of worship kind of like a horse fly when I'm in the country. I'll be in my car in the country in the summer, and there'll be horse flies everywhere. And you hate horse flies. I mean, they're about this big. You know, they take a chunk out of your arm, you know, and like the size of a quarter. And you hate horse flies. But it seems like in the country in the summer, somehow when we get in the car, a horse fly will get in Melissa's Jeep. That horse fly is in there. Sometimes we don't notice it right away because it just goes back to the back and hangs out the luggage. And so it's just back there with the guns and the coolers and whatnot. And you don't really hear it. And then all of a sudden, the thing starts flying around. You might be 40 miles from where you started. We're heading back to Fairview Heights. This horsefly jumps in our Jeep in Alney. I notice it in Salem. And you know what? I roll down the window and I flip that fly out. And I think to myself, man, I bet that fly's disoriented. Right. It was an Alney tiger an hour ago, and now it's a Salem wildcat. I mean, where's home? What direction is it? Where is my family? This fly has to be yelling, right? It got on, and it got off, but it got off somewhere very different than where it got on. We need to think like horse flies when we worship God. Wherever it is you get on, you just need to realize you're going to get off somewhere different. And wherever it is you get off, you can always be assured it's a better place than where you got on. How many of you have ever heard an illustration with a horsefly before? Raise your hand. Perfect. Perfect. Number five, worship is unifying. It's unifying. Worship celebrates what we all have in common. We are sinners saved only by the grace shown us through the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus. And we are all grateful. And we are invited into fellowship with God through the pathway of Jesus Christ. Anything else focuses on what divides us, but worship unites us. It reminds us of what we all have in common. We're all sinners. That's what I love about 12-step programs. Everybody's just got to be real honest right out of the gate. I think every time we come to church, we should start, hi, I'm Shane, and I'm a sinner. Hi, Shane. Be a great place to start, because that's where we are. That is the reality of the situation or the condition that our condition is in. And so what I want to do is I just want to say, when we worship God, we are brought into unity. Doesn't mean we're all going to think alike. Doesn't mean we're all going to vote alike. Doesn't mean we're all going to respond to the news alike. Doesn't mean that we're all going to do this alike or that alike, but what it does mean is that we are brought into unity in Jesus Christ. We are a very diverse church here. We think differently about a lot of things. I think that is one of our real strengths. Scares me sometimes, but it's one of our real strengths. And that's why I think I have to stay so laser focused that we are connected with Jesus, because if we ever get our eyes off of that, there's probably a lot that divides us. But what unites us is our belief that the church exists to connect people with Jesus Christ. And we can get on board with that. And you know what? As we learn to appreciate one another, as we learn to truly love one another, we become better Christians, we become better human beings, we develop empathy. There's nothing bad that happens when you are unified in worship. Number six, worship is healing. Now, I'm going to get a little charismatic on you here, but I believe that when you worship God, you put yourself in a position for God to do miraculous things in your life. I mean, a lot of times we think of worship as like a cell phone that needs batteries, and we worship and you know, we build up our battery. But I think worship's closer to a download. I think we're tapped into this infinite source, and when we worship, we patch cord or we get in that, and God is downloading God's self into us. And I think when we're truly worshiping, man, I think God's healing your hurts from your past. I think God heals bodies. I think God heals broken hearts. I think worship is a healing exercise. If you've never worshiped, you've never opened yourself up to the healing that God does through worship. And then number seven, and I love this one, worship is exploration. It's just exploration. When I was a kid, I used to watch Jacques Cousteau. You guys remember Jacques Cousteau, right? And the Calypso and everything. Jacques Cousteau studied the ocean when nobody knew anything about the ocean. And every show was an adventure. And then Gene Roddenberry took us to space with Star Trek. And every show was an adventure. Worship is exploration. When we worship, we are explorers. We are taken places we could never imagine. We experience emotions we never knew we had. We are connected with a consciousness that is so far beyond and above us that we cannot even comprehend the significance of that moment. You see, we got to learn to worship forward. We got to learn to worship somewhere. Worship takes us somewhere. For me, every time I pick up the Bible, I'm thinking, God, how can I better know you? What will you teach me about yourself today? How can I better understand the height and depth and breadth of your love? How can I better know your character and your intentions? Dear God, I just want to know you. Worship is exploration. So here's the deal as we close. You and I were created first and foremost to worship God. It is the first and the greatest commandment. When you worship, you are fulfilling your best destiny, and your ability or inability to actually worship will determine everything about your life. Everything about your life. Worship is not something we have to force ourselves to do, like exercise in the morning. Worship is not something that can only be done in one place. Worship is something we naturally do once distractions are removed, because we were created for it. See, we think of prayer often in terms of a formalized structure, and prayer is good in a formalized structure, but Paul talked about praying with groanings that could not be uttered. He said to pray without ceasing, to tap into a stream of consciousness in which my goal is not to pray a lot. My goal would be that my life would become a prayer and that I am tapped into the stream of God's consciousness every day. I am God aware every moment of every day. And when you do that, you end up back with the old hymn writer, and he walks with me and he talks with me. And he tells me I am his own. What a beautiful, beautiful idea. You ever think of prayer as exploration? Prayer is a form of worship in which we probe the heart of our Creator. You ever think of Bible reading as exploration? You ever think of church as exploration? Sounds a lot more fun than attendance. Attendance is what we did at school, right? Shane Bishop, here! That's attendance. Worship as exploration. That's a horsefly riding in a Jeep right there. Next week, we're going to continue the theme, and we're going to look at the temptation of Christ, and we're going to look at the fact that the temptation of Christ via Satan really centered around worship. Because it's the most important thing we do, the temptations come around that. So we're going to take a look at not only the temptations concerning worship, but how do we overcome those temptations concerning worship? How do we truly become victors in our Christian lives? So I'm going to close with two very simple questions. Did you actually worship God tonight? Or did you just sit in church? And if you didn't truly worship, why in the world didn't